You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome. There's a newly recognized mental health condition called gaming disorder. We're going to tell you about that later this hour. First, our top story. Once there was a head tax. A tax on every employee of Seattle's highest grossing businesses. It would have raised $40 million a year for affordable housing and homeless services. Then the tax was gone. A campaign to repeal it got more than 45,000 signatures, and the Seattle City Council rolled it back last week. So what is next? I asked Seattle's mayor, Jenny Durkin, how will the city pay for affordable housing and homeless services now?
Well, you have to break those two things down. On the affordable housing front, we're going to work very hard with the state and the county to make sure we can have as many investments in long-term housing as we can. And I think the county will be making some announcements this week on that front. And the state legislature and the governor have committed to working that issue as well. On the homeless services front, we will make sure that we continue to provide more shelter. City Council's taking up my proposal today. If they pass it, we will have the largest increase in temporary shelter in the city of Seattle. This will let us get more people out of tents, out of cars, and off the streets into somewhere safer and improve the city.
Where is that money coming from, Mayor?
This was one of the first bills I introduced when I became mayor. We sold a piece of property and used just a portion of that property to fund bridge shelter services, including rental vouchers for people to prevent them falling into homelessness and more shelter opportunities. So there will be a range of shelters, everything from tiny house villages to bringing people into City Hall, to creating places where there's some opportunities, like a former housing place that's not being utilized.
So that's a one-time sale of property. Will you propose any other tax to replace the lost revenue of the head tax? Will you cut other spending?
No, right now we're in the middle of budget season, and we will be looking in from department by department as I have been. You'll recall that I asked each of the departments to cut their budget, and we are looking at savings everywhere. So when I came in, for example, we looked at the Seattle Department of Transportation to make sure that all those projects were running on budget and on time. We had to make some adjustments, like pausing the streetcar until we could find out more. So we'll be looking at all areas in the budget to see where we can have savings and where we can make investments to keep people safe and do the services that everyone expects in Seattle.
I talked about Seattle's transportation spending and spending in general with one of the leaders of the Repeal the Head Tax campaign, Saul Spady, and he told me that the fact that Seattle has doubled its spending on homelessness and there are more people homeless than before is the latest in a string of broken promises, and he mentioned transportation spending. Listen to this.
We're a little discouraged by the city's ability to spend its money wisely. I mean, we could say the Seattle streetcar, or we could say bike paths. And I think we all kind of have a perspective that the city promises a lot and delivers very little sometimes.
Is it fair to oppose Seattle taxes on the grounds that the city won't spend the money well?
I don't think so. Here's what I know, though. People expect their money to be spent wisely, and they need to know where it's going. In addition to spending money more wisely, we have to have more transparency so people know where their dollars are being spent. You know, it is why I put the pause on the streetcar, so people would understand how much is it going to cost to build, how much will it cost to operate. Until we know those things, we can't commit long term to it. Same with the Seattle levy on transportation levy. There were a number of projects that were undervalued at the time. We have to be honest with people about what we can afford. On homelessness spending, I would say we have moved more people out of homelessness into long-term housing than ever before. Thousands. The problem is we have more people falling into homelessness. We have not been able to get ahead of this. So it can't happen just Seattle acting alone. It has to be regional solutions, and we have to do it on three levels. First, we have to do more to prevent homelessness, and that's what we've been trying to do on a regional basis. Second, we have to provide emergency services to get people out of tents and out of RVs into safe places. And third, we have to have more affordable housing in the region. Seattle and the region have just become too expensive, and too many people cannot afford to be in Seattle.
Mayor Durkin, critics of the head tax complained that there was no spending plan for the money. They said that's the main reason why the head tax sank. Is that true?
I heard from people all over Seattle different things about why they did not support having the head tax. And I think that it was smart of us to listen, to pause, reset, and to have a plan moving forward. Moving out of City Council today is the first part of the plan on emergency services. The other part of the plan is working with the county and the other mayors in this region, which I've been doing, to see if we can have a system to prevent homelessness in the first place. And the third part of the plan is to build more affordable housing as quickly as we can. You know, we committed over $100 million at the end of last year for affordable housing. With the amounts we're able to get from the federal government and others, that will result in almost $300 million of new affordable housing. That's a huge investment. The county will be making some announcements on investments. So we have to move as quickly as we can to build more affordable housing. And I think that if we show people we have a plan on all three of those things, how to prevent homelessness, how to deal with people who are experiencing homelessness, and how to have our region be more affordable so that people can live here. And I want to emphasize, it's not just deeply affordable low-income housing. We need more middle-class housing. Our teachers, our firefighters, our police, people who work in the city can't afford to live in the city. We have to change that. So you're going to see a plan on those investments as well.
Regarding the regional solution on homelessness, the Seattle Times quoted people on the regional group known as One Table saying they haven't gotten any formal communication since April 27th and they're in the dark as to what's next. What do you say about that? What's going on?
Look, I think we live in the microwave society where people expect to see results immediately. One Table was never intended to be immediate solutions. It's looking at the systemic causes of homelessness, the upstream causes. We had to take a pause, and I will admit it, because the head tax debate was so impassioned, and we had to see what revenues would be or would not be coming from that area, that energies were diverted. But that doesn't mean that I wasn't working at the same time. Even though we weren't having meetings of the group, I continued to meet with providers, with mayors from the region, with the county executive, talk to the governor, and see where are those solutions that we can get as a region. I spent last weekend at the U.S. Conference of Mayors and talked to the mayors of the cities up and down the West Coast who are experiencing this to see where there's lessons we can learn. You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can learn from San Diego, for example, on how perhaps we can do vehicle safe lots better. We can learn from Los Angeles on how we can have better accountability overall. So I think that we will continue to work, not just in this region, but to listen from other cities and experts that are doing it better. This is a problem that will continue over time. It has been years in the making, and it will be years to really undo it. But everybody wants to see progress and a plan. And so today marks the first part of the emergency services plan. We also have a plan for long-term housing, and we have to have a plan for the root causes of homelessness as well.
You mentioned vehicle safe lots, Mayor, and the county's latest homeless count found a big increase in people living in cars and RVs. Safe lots have been tried and then in some cases abandoned. So is the city going to try again with so-called safe lots, and how many and where?
We're going to look at a region-wide on how to do this. What the city tried before I became mayor didn't work. It was far too expensive, and it didn't help enough people. There's no question about that. But if you look at areas like San Diego, they're able to have a much more simple process for that. So we'll look at that to determine where and when it would be appropriate in Seattle.
Well, what's the key to that simplicity in San Diego?
The key to the simplicity is to make sure that you provide safety but not have too many costs incurred around it. So we were building it for all services and all the things that went with the lot. Sometimes people just want a safe place. But long term, we've also been doing a pilot throughout Seattle that we've had great success in making sure that even when we can't move the vehicles, we can make sure that there's no accumulation of trash and garbage and things like that. We have moved thousands and thousands of pounds of garbage in and around vehicles. We will continue to do that to make sure that there's not the impact on the communities and neighborhoods that people see every day.
You know, Amazon seemed to be involved in that bargain you struck to reduce the size of the head tax, but after it passed, Amazon gave $25,000 to the repeal campaign, and Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda accused Amazon of reneging on a deal. She called it a hollow handshake. Did Amazon go back on its word to you?
Look, I don't think it's beneficial for any of us to look in the rearview mirror or do blame. What we have to do is how we're going to move forward. And I will work with every business, Amazon, Starbucks, and our larger businesses, but also our small businesses who feel these impacts every day, not just in and around their businesses, but their workers are some of the ones most impacted by our affordability crisis in Seattle. So my focus as mayor is not to look in the rearview mirror. My focus is how do we get a plan together to make sure that we make Seattle a better place to live and work. Every day, that's what I'm thinking about, and every day, that's what I'm going to focus on.
Seattle can seem so divided against itself these days, Mayor Dirk. And here are, you mentioned you're listening to the people, but here are just two people who attended last week's public hearing with opposite takes on the head tax.
We want you to start to enforce the law, close the campgrounds, and have some accountability for once. You guys have wasted hundreds of millions of dollars. We are done with it.
We have homeless families sleeping in the parking lot every night. We have children sleeping in the parking lot. This is a sin in such a rich area as ours. And I believe we have a moral imperative to give all our families a home.
So, Mayor, when you say you're listening to the people, how do you know which people are you listening to and how can you bring the city together more?
You know, I think that Seattle never lacks for passion, which is a good thing. But if you get in a quiet moment and talk to people on both sides of the divide of the head tax, you'll hear some very similar things. People in Seattle are generous and have a generous spirit. They want to help and they want to make a difference. At the same time, there is a long tradition in this town for people wanting to make sure the government is accountable and their taxpayer dollars are being used wisely. People have lost a lot of faith in government, not just here in Seattle, but across the country. It's a time where people are questioning institutions. It's our job, it's my job, it's the city council's job to show the people that we are using those taxpayer dollars wisely, that we know what it takes for them to pay those taxes, and that we know the impacts that all these issues have on their lives every day. So that's our job as government, and I think if we try to get in to every community, to work with people, to talk to people, and to make a difference, in the long run, we can have more solutions that people accept. But it also requires everybody stepping up, and I think that that's the other thing we have to have a call to is everyone has been contributing through tax dollars. Now Seattle's going to make sure that everyone in the region also steps up. I'm meeting with a number of the mayors from the region. Mayor Baucus and I have talked about it to pull people together because it's not just Seattle that's experiencing these issues. It's up and down the I-5 corridor and throughout Washington State. I'm meeting with our state legislative delegation in the coming weeks. I've talked to the governor. We have to have a bigger plan than anybody has had to deal with this as a region.
Talking with Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, one final question on the head tax. The original head tax was steeper. You supported a reduced version, and that still didn't satisfy Seattle businesses. Do you regret supporting the head tax at all?
Look, we chose a path that we thought would bring people together and was supported by enough businesses that it would be the compromise that people could live with. We heard for a lot of different reasons that it did not have the support in Seattle. We now have to hit reset, and we have to show people that we're going to make progress. That's our job to do. And so again, I think looking forward, my job as mayor is to continue to be out listening to people in every part of the city, but also to be taking a hard look at where we're using our money and how we're going to make the biggest difference, and to make sure that everyone in the region steps up to this challenge because Seattle cannot do it alone.
Does that mean no regrets? There's no regretting in politics?
You know, I don't think regret is helpful to people. I think we did what we thought was best at the time, and we had backing from a range of businesses. It was clear after it passed that it did not have support, and it was the channel for a lot of people's disappointment and disillusionment with government and what's happening in Seattle. Our job is to recognize that. You know, I think, you know, government should not fight the people. We're supposed to represent the people. And so listening to people, hitting reset, and then getting back to work to continue the progress moving forward, we have to make those investments that are smart. The other thing coming out of City Council today is the Family and Education Levy. It is probably the singular best investment that anyone living in the city of Seattle can make. It is our future. It is our kids. It is opportunity. And it is the thing that we can do that has a concrete result to make Seattle a more affordable place and the city that continues to invent the future.
What is the news with the Families and Education Levy?
Families and Education Levy, the City Council will be passing it out today, hopefully. Then it goes to the ballot in November. And that is the time when the two levies are expiring. Both the Families and Education Levy and our preschool levy are both expiring. We've combined the two, and we've expanded pre-K so that we're almost doubling the number of kids that can get good quality early learning, which data proves makes them more successful throughout their education career. We're also going to provide every Seattle Public School graduate with 2 years of education at community colleges. That will give them the ticket to opportunity. There's over 700,000 jobs that are estimated to be created in this region in the next 5 to 7 years, but almost all of them require some post-high school education. Only 30% of our kids are getting that. So we're telling most of our kids, these jobs of the future, you can't have them. We've got to change that if we want to change Seattle as an affordable city. We want to make sure the best jobs can go from the talent grown right here.
Is Seattle levied out? Is there tax fatigue in Seattle?
There's no question there's tax fatigue, but everywhere I go, people are very discerning. Seattle voters are smart, and they know and believe that education is one of the best investments we can make. Investing in our kids is not only the right thing to do for those kids, but it's the smart thing to do because we want those kids to go on to great jobs. We don't want to have to support them through various social services in the future because we failed them as children. So giving this investment today pays off, not just today, but in the long run.
On another subject, Mayor, Seattle has bid to host some World Cup matches at CenturyLink Field in 2026. How much would that cost the city on balance? There would be some money brought in. On balance, do you know what the price tag would be for Seattle?
On balance, we don't know yet, but if you look at the history of the World Cups and events like that, it should be a net positive for Seattle. There obviously is cost related to public safety, street closures, and support like that. But at the same time, the increase into the economy from people coming here to view World Cup games will be tremendous. I think that it would be fantastic for Seattle to be one of the cities in the World Cup. If you turn on your TV and you watch some of these matches that are being played right now, it is really an international sport where people all over the world watch them. I want everyone in the world to see Seattle and see how great it is. And I also want to see grass in the clink.
Permanently or just grass brought in for the World Cup?
Grass brought in for the World Cup. It's one of the requirements, and they've been studying how to do it. And I think that it will be in a different kind of sport played on grass there. And I think people will really enjoy it. This is such a great soccer town. It always has been. I grew up watching the original Sounders as a kid. Going to see the rain game, if you haven't done it in the summer, it's a great place to spend an evening. So I'm hoping that the World Cup comes here. We're not in the World Cup right now, unfortunately, so I was really rooting for Iceland.
Iceland, huh?
Yeah, they held off Messi. He wasn't able to score. So if I don't have a team in the game, I usually root for the underdog.
Mayor Durkan, rooting for Iceland this time around with no Team USA on a hot day in Seattle, Washington. Mayor, good to talk with you.
On a hot day, everyone stay cool.
Stay cool. Good to talk with you.
Thank
you
so
much.
Take care.
Bye-bye, Mayor.
All right, bye-bye.
And we'll be debating the big news stories later this week on Week in Review, and we're inviting you in. This is a live show in Bellevue this Thursday evening, so come say hi to me, Bill Radke, and our Week in Review panel at Bellevue Arts Museum. This Thursday, June 21st, a free event, by the way. So just go to kuow.org/engage, see where it says Week in Review live tour, click there, and RSVP for the Bellevue show. You can get into the museum for free at 6 o'clock, and the show begins at 7:30. So come say hi this Thursday, Bellevue Arts Museum. My next guest was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in the late 1990s. Cartoonist Ellen Forney says back then there wasn't much information available, just lots of stigma. She wrote a memoir about her experience, wrote it and drew it. She's a cartoonist. The book was called Marbles, and the New York Times praised its vigor, wit, and visual inventiveness. Her new book is called Rock Steady, Brilliant Advice from My Bipolar Life. Ellen Forney, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
You've said that a symptom of mania is believing you're completely in control of your life. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think about a day that you feel just full of hope and things are going to be all right, and just this really deep sense of everything is really interconnected and things are there, sort of a universal truth. It's a rare feeling for most of us. And that is something that is certainly for me was a feeling that I would have fairly often.
That sounds fantastic.
Well, that's the thing. In my latest book, Rock Steady, Brilliant Advice from My Bipolar Life, I have some little faces saying the different things that are difficult challenges in trying to remain stable. And a lot of that is feeling romanticizing and feeling tempted by a memory of mania. And next to one of those heads, I have kind of like a mouth with a very seductive mouth with fangs, like a sexy Dracula fangs, mm-hmm. saying, kiss me. It's very seductive. It can be very seductive. But if you think of somebody who's really speedy, I mean, if you've ever known anybody who has a speed or a cocaine problem or something like that, who's talking really fast and is really into what, you know, like very specifically, you know, self-centered and that kind of thing, they're difficult to be around.
When you were feeling that way, you were feeling in control and on top of the world, were there important things that you were actually out of control of?
Well, sure. That's the flip side of the experience, even at the time, is feeling really compelled, is feeling really irritable. I mean, I know that part of that feeling like extra excited would mean if something kind of fell through. You know, get stuck in traffic, for example. You know, it would be so aggravating just if you think about having your whole self with that kind of extra energy that, for the most part, goes in this real, like, up direction, but it can kind of sort of bank shot into a different direction. So that's why, after a period of mania, there is inevitably, this fall into depression. The body is just exhausted. The mind is just exhausted.
You call telling people that you have bipolar disorder coming out. Do you have a coming out story?
There's one that's in Rock Steady about coming out to my partner now. We've been together for 9 years, but in the very beginning, my telling him that I had bipolar disorder was kind of clunky.
Clunky, yeah.
Yeah. No, I intended to be kind of smooth about it, but I just blurted it out. We were sharing a hotel room, and I had to take my meds, and he was in the shower. And I couldn't decide whether I should take them fast and deal with coming out later or just kind of be casual about it. And he got out of the shower and I hadn't decided yet. And so I just kind of blurted it out. But we survived that.
What was his reaction, may I ask?
Well, he was, as I know him to be, he was warm and understanding and made some comment about how he had gone to art school. And so it was something that wasn't entirely new to him.
Yeah.
And we got beyond that. He did say that that it wasn't the bipolar part that made him nervous, because he was actually a little nervous, but it was the blurt part in the way that I said it.
Hmm.
But one of the things, just to kind of like follow that up, one of the things in Rock Steady, when I was putting Rock Steady together, that was really important to me, was getting back to being human and taking care of yourself and having a certain amount of flexibility in that, and knowing that you're going to mess up sometimes. And so you can know all of the things that you should do. I knew that I should either like save that disclosure for later or really be, you know, like be calm about it and be ready to answer questions. And I just didn't do that. But, you know, it wound up being okay, you know, or it might be fixable. You know, more often
fixable
than not,
is a good
it'll be
word.
Okay.
A lot of things are fixed. They're not perfect, but they're fixable.
Right, right. It's not a slippery slope. It doesn't mean that you're a failure. It's just par for the course. And it's just folded into the bigger picture of taking care of yourself.
This is Ellen Forney, whose new book is Rock Steady, Brilliant Advice from My Bipolar Life. And you get it. Your book is a kind of a toolkit in part. And you do get into stuff that's good advice for all of us.
Right.
Right? I mean, get your sleep. Eat right.
Right.
Take your meds.
Right.
Have a support system.
Or take your meds if you take meds.
If you take meds.
Right. Right.
Don't,
right.
Be off your meds.
Right. Well, I think there is a... So this is a tricky thing. That's why I came up with the acronym SMEDMERTS for my sort of like a health strategy. I'll just rattle that off. Sleep, meds if you take meds, eat in a way that nourishes you, E-D, see your doctor or whatever therapy is working for you, D-M, meditation, mindfulness, exercise, routine, tools, coping tools, and a solid support system. And all of those things are really important.
I think most of us would agree about sleep and exercise and a support system. But you, the M's you mentioned, mindfulness, meditation, you've changed your relationship to your thoughts, would you say?
That practice is very effective for a lot of the different aspects that I was talking about, like calming yourself. Focusing on your breathing kind of allows you to calm down and focus. Being able to kind of relax, the sort of get outside of that frazzled brain and get some perspective away from that. It helps you sleep. It helps you get through your day. It helps, like, there again, if you're in traffic and you're just, you know, like getting really in a snarl and you're getting to the place on time and what are those other people doing that, you know, like that's so stupid, that if you can be like, oh, this is what's going on in this moment. I'm going to kind of like take a step back. What's going on? My heart is racing. My breath is getting shallow. You know, I am here right now. So what am I going to do? I'm going to relax. I'm going to breathe. I'm going to just like, you know, think about where I am and kind of give yourself a little distance and time to just not be freaking out that way.
You talk about your talking back to your internal critic.
Right.
Have you used that personally? Are there thoughts that you've been able to question or take less seriously?
So that exercise, that kind of skill, that's part of CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a very rational, skill-based way to deal with primarily depression, where you put on, let's say, the left column, the different thoughts that are going through your head that tend to bounce around in your head. Let's say, for example, like, I'll never find a partner, or I am never going to be successful in my work, or I'll never
be unlovable.
I'm unlovable, those things. And then in the right column, when you're, you know, like sitting calmly and rationally and you're writing these things down, you write something that sort of answers to that, like, I can't know that. I still have much life to live, and I have had such and such in the past, and I don't know that it might happen in the future, that kind of thing. So I've used that in the past, and it definitely, that kind of thing becomes a part of your consciousness, or it just becomes a part of your habits. It's like folded into what I might naturally do in my thoughts.
Suicide prevention's in the news, especially with Anthony Bourdain, Kate Spade dying. And often the advice is ask for help, reach out and ask for help.
Right.
How hard is that to do when you're depressed, for example?
Well, as you might imagine, it's one of the hardest things to do. In feeling really, really down and depressed, I mean, part of that is feeling worthless and hopeless and unlovable. And so reaching out is a really, really hard thing to do. It's important to have that support system that you can reach out to for help. Have that established for the long term, for now.
Starting
for
now.
Smaller things, right?
Yeah.
Like I knew when I was in the depths of depression, I knew that my mother loved me, even though I felt that she was deluded, that But I knew that, and I knew that I could call her and that she would love me. But it's important to know what to do when we are actually in a crisis. It's maybe even more important to have that support system established.
It shouldn't be so exceptional that we get to hear a caring, supportive voice, you know, and can bounce things off. It's not just an emergency.
Right, right.
It's life.
Well, I think it's really important. A lot of the consciousness that's going on right now is on reaching out to other people too. I almost always, in any of the readings that I do, get a question, a very caring, loving question from someone from the audience. How do I reach out to my son, daughter, friend, coworker, who I think is having a problem or who I know is having a problem? And it is a very subjective thing. It's a very difficult thing to answer. The main thing is to be there and to listen and not feel like you have to give advice. But on the other side of that question, it's as the person who has the disorder myself, I'm still responsible for myself. I can still reach out. I guess it's a really tricky balance in figuring out what this message is. It's important for people to reach out to other people, period. It's also important for those of us who are feeling compromised to know that we're not powerless. There are things that we can do ourselves.
Smedmerts,
exactly. For the long term and in crises.
Ellen Forney, you may know her for her memoir, Marbles. Whether you do or not, her new book is called Rock Steady, Brilliant Advice from My Bipolar Life. Ellen, thanks a lot for this.
Thanks so much for having me.
And coming up here on The Record, we'll tell you about some of the news stories you might have missed over a warm Father's Day weekend. So stay tuned. That's coming up. Welcome back to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Killer whales, gaming addiction, and pregnancy discrimination. Some news stories you might have missed over the weekend. And here to tell you more is our Monday news panel. And this time we have Kevin Schofield, writer and editor at SCC Insight, an independent site that reports on the Seattle City Council. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me back.
And Karen Wise, Seattle reporter for Bloomberg Business Week and Bloomberg Technology. Good to see you, Karen.
You too.
Kevin, you brought us a story about our declining local orca population.
Yeah, so it was announced over the weekend that one more of our southern resident orcas has gone missing and is presumed dead. That brings the total down to 75 right now, which is the lowest it's been in 34 years.
This is a 23-year-old male orca nicknamed Cruiser. Hasn't been seen in more than 6 months. And so what does that say? For those who don't follow the orca situation, what do we blame this decline on?
Well, this is sort of death of a thousand cuts. Over the last 70, 80 years, we've done pretty much every awful thing we can possibly do to orcas in Puget Sound. We dumped a bunch of PCBs out there. We dammed up our rivers, decimated the salmon runs, which is what our local orcas feed on. In the late 60s and early 70s, we live captured all the juvenile males out of the southern resident population and sent them to marine parks, which, go figure, they had a hard time reproducing after that.
Mm. And by the way, when we say southern resident, this is relatively, southern is
right.
Relative speaking.
Yeah, so,
this is the off the BC and Washington state.
Right. So if you think about Vancouver Island, there's one set of orcas called the northern residents, which hang out around the north end of Vancouver Island. And there's one set called the southern residents that hang around at the south end of Vancouver Island and around the San Juan Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so the last thing that we did is nowadays we follow them around with a whole fleet of whale watching boats.
Yeah. Yeah. What can our listeners do about that? Never go whale watching?
Well, there's lots of places where you can go whale watching from shore rather mm-hmm. than going out on the boats. But I think, politically, there's some things that we're going to have to just wrestle with long term, like what do we do about all these dams we have on our rivers, which, if we care not just about the orcas, but about salmon population and that whole ecosystem, We've really done some serious damage to rivers in the Pacific Northwest by damming up so much of them. That's a particularly difficult political thorny issue, but it's one we're going to have to face.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court just said Washington State's on the hook to fix a bunch of culverts, those pipes that run underneath roads and make life harder for salmon.
That's right.
So the orca, that's one endangered species. Karen, you're following news of another one.
Yes, the wolves. It's very interesting. Similar idea of when you have one species that can affect a whole ecosystem and the whole fall off from when one species kind of rises and falls. And so wolves have been coming back in the U.S. in the past couple decades after their reintroduction in Yellowstone. And there were none in the Northwest for a long time, for decades, after the government also supported essentially poaching of the wolves. And so the big news from late last week is that the U.S. government's considering delisting wolves from the endangered species list across the lower 48. They're currently delisted in eastern Washington, a number of neighboring states, but not in western Washington and elsewhere. Although they are protected in their state law, so there's this kind of mishmash of things. But it's an example of, in general, a population that has been reintroduced, generally seen as successfully, and rebounded. And so there's a regular periodic review that happens that says, should the species still be on the list? And the wolves are up, and the question will be also in this federal administration, how much it's contested science as it is, and obviously this is a moment of very contested science nationally anyway. So it'll be really interesting to watch how that unfolds. In particular, there's people care a lot about wolves in the state. There's conservationists, there's hikers, there's hunters, there's cattle ranchers. So a lot of people have stake in this.
Yeah, basically, if the federal government were to delist across all of Washington state, it would give ranchers and wildlife managers more latitude to kill the wolves that attack livestock?
Potentially, because it relieves some of the responsibility on the state from what the state has to do. The state has its own set of laws as well. And also it depends as the wolves continue to spread. So far, they've only stayed in eastern Washington. But as they spread, presumably continue to expand their territory, which they have been doing, it'll be a big question of how much protections they'll get then.
I don't know what I would have guessed as far as the number of gray wolves in this area, but I would have guessed way more than the reality, which, according to what I read, is about 120 gray wolves in Oregon and Washington.
Well, per state.
Per state, each.
Per state,
so
yeah.
240-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah. On another subject, Karen, you flagged a New York Times piece, an investigation that they titled Pregnancy Discrimination is Rampant Inside America's Biggest Companies.
Yeah, what was interesting to me about this story is there are protections against discrimination during pregnancy, and there's questions kind of on the legal edge of that. But some of the examples in this story were just straight out, I mean, they seem to be illegal, just complete violation of the type of protections you have, the type of accommodations for pregnancy, and let alone after, you know, people returning to work.
Did the piece in the New York Times said that there was a quote, many of the country's largest and most prestigious companies still systematically sideline pregnant women. They pass them over for promotions and raises. They fire them when they complain. How surprising was that piece to you?
It's interesting. In some sense, it's shocking when you still to see some things in print and to see things kind of that have gone through a fact-checking process as rigorous as that. In another sense, pregnancy discrimination is clearly a thing that happens. And I have a toddler. And so I recently was just surprised when I was pregnant about the physicality of the entire pregnancy. I had kind of assumed before, yeah, when you get huge, you're uncomfortable, whatever. But like, no, it was like 10 really physically challenging months, and I had a healthy pregnancy.
Did you feel you were discriminated against in the workplace?
I did not, actually. I had a great accommodation. I had a pumping room once I had a baby. Actually, my pump room was kind of a closet, but also had a view of the Space Needle, so I felt very lucky in that sense, a fridge to store my milk in. But you talk to people, including people that work at companies that pride themselves in promoting a safe and kind of equal environment, a lot of tech companies, and they still have problems, everything from debating how much to travel for work in the final days of their pregnancy to having access to pumping facilities at industry conferences. There are still industry conferences that don't accommodate that at all. So it takes a lot to be supportive.
So one of the issues that comes up around this a lot is that while there are laws in the books which prohibit a lot of these things, oftentimes attorneys don't want to take these cases on because you know, they may not make any money, even if they win, right? It may not cover their cost to do this. So
why not?
It just may be the way the law is written. So one of the things that our city council here has done with a lot of the labor laws that they've written is they've written what's called a private right of action, which allows me, if my employer does something, you know, breaks a law, you know, these kinds of labor laws, not only to file a complaint with the city, but to sue directly, in which case an attorney could get, you know, attorney's fees and costs covered, if not, you know, a percentage of, you know, whatever compensation is given back. So there's, you know, more incentive for attorneys to say, hey, all right, I'm, you know, this is not a pro bono thing for me. I'm really willing to take this case and fight for, you know, the good guys in this, and make sure we're really enforcing these laws, because it's not just going to be, you know, a bunch of money down the, you know, down the sink for me.
Finally, the World Health Organization recognized a new mental health condition today, gaming disorder. And here's a little description. This is Hillary Cash, a co-founder of an inpatient treatment program for video game addiction here in Fall City. It's called Restart. And she told CNN how gaming addiction affects players.
They do lose control. Their impulse to just go online and game and do whatever else they want to do online, that is stronger than whatever it is they tell themselves they should be doing.
Karen, you've done some reporting on this. What do you think of an official gaming disorder?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's actually kind of controversial in many ways, because there's a question of, is this a distinct thing, or is there a series of addiction, addictive-like behaviors that people have, and it affects how you treat them? Is there something that's unique about gaming versus internet addiction versus smartphone addiction versus gambling addiction? But at the same time, there is more of a body of research around gaming than these other issues. It follows on the footsteps of gambling disorder, which was the first behavioral addictive disorder. Previously, all addictions were more like drug use or some external stimulant that you put in your body.
Here's the reaction from the Entertainment Software Association. Quote, legitimate science, objective research, and common sense all prove video games are not addictive. By misusing the word addiction, which is a medical term, society demeans real compulsive behaviors like alcoholism and drug abuse, which deserve treatment, compassion, and care. Kevin, what did you think of this?
I think that's a lie. It's just a flat-out lie. And you look at, as Karen was saying, you look at the spectrum across slot machines and gambling addiction and video games, and how both, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram are all designed, and the design principles are the same across all of them. They're short, very small activities that immediately give you a reward that's going to trigger the dopamine receptors in your brain, and you get in this feedback loop where you just keep doing it because you keep getting rewarded for doing these small things, and you do it forever. You know, I used to work in the software industry. I can, you know, doing user interface design. These are well-known designs.
Were you an addictor? You were designing how to make more addictive games?
I didn't work on the kinds of products that would get people addicted. I worked on far more boring kind of stuff than that. Mm. But these are well-known design principles. You know, there's a reason slot machines are designed the way slot machines are, right? Because that kind of activity, you pull the lever, blip, 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 and something happens, pull the lever, and they know just how often to make sure you get at least a little bit of a win, you know, on one of the pulls in the slot machine to keep you coming back.
Well, what about the fact that you could be a professional gambler or a professional gamer, not a professional drinker or a professional smoker? I mean, you can get an e-sports scholarship to a university now. You know, we wouldn't say a basketball star has a disorder. We'd say, what a hard worker.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are different classes of these things, right? There are certainly games which are less addictive. And we should be careful, you know, to that point, not to broad brush all video games and say they are all addictive, right? That's certainly not true, right?
Just the poorly designed ones are not addictive?
Well, you know, I think the designers would tell you that they're not poorly designed. I think, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has said some things recently about the design of Facebook, to say, hey, all companies, when they're designing, you know, software, whether it's Facebook or, you know, Microsoft Word or what other kinds of programs they are designing for you, they want to maximize the amount of time you're using it. right? That is their job, because they make more money if you feel that that piece of software is more valuable to you. You're going to pay more for it. You're going to spend more time with it, more and less time with your, you know, competitors' products. And so they really want to maximize the amount of time that you spend with their product. And they're going to use whatever design principles they have to do that.
Karen, is an addiction to a building game like Minecraft the same as an addiction to a fighting game or a sports game?
You know, I actually am not a gamer, so I'm probably the wrong person to ask this question to. But one thing that did strike me when I was interviewing researchers in this field was that they said that, you know, most people can play games and not be addicted. And that's not everyone has the disorder. Not every game or not everyone is predisposition to be addicted to something. And so I forget the exact percentages, but it was certainly somewhere in the neighborhood of 5% or fewer of users might be of gamers might be addicted. And I believe it was actually even smaller than that. And the interesting thing when you're trying to define in a kind of technical terms a disorder is it has to be prevalent enough to have some meaning and some unique characteristics. But if it's so broad, it's probably not actually a good description of something too. So the folks, researchers I were talking with were trying to caution that, yes, this can be a thing, but it's not like no one should play a game ever, or yeah, no one should make games ever. And there are these something like 2/3 of Americans regularly play games. It's a huge number. I mean, the esports numbers are staggering. If you've ever been to one of those events where people are cheering, it's pretty cool. So it is complicated and it is relatively new research, because gaming as we know it is a relatively new phenomenon. It's only really been developed in a home in the past 2 decades.
We're talking about the World Health Organization recognizing a mental health condition called gaming disorder. Covering some of the stories you might have missed over a warm Father's Day weekend, Karen Wise, Seattle reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek and Bloomberg Technology. Kevin Schofield, writer-editor at SCC Insight, reporting on the Seattle City Council. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Here's a story for you. For about 8 years, a little monastery has kept an obscure Buddhist tradition alive in the gorge, Columbia River Gorge. The monks who live there depend entirely on a community of supporters to survive, and that's by design. Reporter Bradley Parks tells you about the relationship that's blossomed between one Washington town and the Buddhist monks who call it home.
A small house and a few huts sit at the end of a potholed gravel road in the Columbia River Gorge. Inside, three Buddhist monks prepare for their one daily meal. The monks are alms mendicants. That is, they can only eat what they're freely given. They can't ask for food or store excess. They can't possess or use money. They can't farm.
We live dependent on the support of people offering, out of a sense of goodwill or inspiration, the necessities of life.
That's Ajahn Sudanto, abbot of Pacific Hermitage in White Salmon, Washington. They chose this place because it's far enough away from Portland for the monks to enjoy relative seclusion, but it's close enough to a town where they can maintain their practice. He and the other monks follow a forest-dwelling Buddhist tradition that focuses on disciplined meditation as a path to enlightenment. Rules are designed to help monks eliminate worldly stresses and desires, to focus instead on training the mind. So they get help from outsiders. Every morning, the monks walk these winding trails a mile or so into White Salmon, past trees and rocks covered in electric green moss. They collect food from local supporters on this daily alms round. If people don't give, the monks don't eat.
You know, it's not just a game right, or an empty ritual. In some sense, we're walking our talk and putting ourselves out there.
For nearly a decade, the monks have found the support they need to survive in the gorge, and that's largely because community members see benefits in return. The monks offer things like free meditation at the yoga center in town every week. People can receive Buddhist teachings from them, too. Colleen Regal-Budo helps organize food offerings for the monks.
I think it's just inspiring for people to see these people who focus their lives on cultivating compassion and kindness and don't have possessions and who exist to lead a life of contemplation and service.
Complete isolation or exclusivity aren't options for the monks of the gorge. Longpor Pasano co-founded the California-based Parent Monastery of Pacific Hermitage. He says monks' experience and expertise must benefit the lay community for a monastery to last.
Because otherwise it's just either empty philosophy or just empty rules. It's not useful or applicable to our daily life, and that's not, the Buddha's teachings are very much about how we live it, as opposed to what we believe in.
Less than 1% of Americans identify as Buddhist. Washington is one of the least religious states in the country. Some here still express fear of the monks. Here's Ajahn Sudanto.
Oh, well, probably the most timely and colorful one right now was we did hear a rumor that some people were heard to exclaim, "They're back," meaning the Rajneeshis.
But Sudanto said reception over the years has been mostly positive.
The dress, the guys, the lifestyle is part of like holding that space in a communal and a public way as a reminder of that part of the human experience and how human societies value that experience.
And in White Salmon, monks have found a community that values that experience enough to keep it around. I'm Bradley Parks in White Salmon, Washington.
And thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW Seattle, produced today by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Kara McDermott. I'm Bill Radke, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.